The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. It's another live one with a human being face to face. I'm with Adam Lowy, the founder and, would I say, kind of winemaker for Cloudsley Cellars, the head winemaker. Everyone's very different with this. So how do you best like to be referred to?
Well, I'm not great with titles myself.
Yeah.
But when pressed, I'd say I'm the executive winemaker. Mm-hmm. We have a fantastic winemaking team, and they do the majority of the hands-on work. But I do all of the final blending decisions, all the barrel decisions, picking decisions, and all these sort of things. And moreover, the wine's made to my palate. It's what I believe is the right expression in the end. But I don't claim to have the knowledge that they do as far as some of the technical things. They've all been to winemaking school, and I have not.
But it's your philosophy, and you know you're the one sort of shaping it. So yes, and if you're dealing with the blending and stuff, I'm joined by founder and winemaker for Cloudsley Cellars, Adam Lowy. I feel pretty good about that. I'm already angry. I don't want to release this episode until, at the very least, I purchased a case. We tasted two of your Chardonnays. We tasted four Pinots, including three single vineyard. And for people listening, Cloudsley Cellars is another answer I will give to mostly more men than women, but more men when they say, I don't want to drink Ontario red wine. I would put down one of your bottles, especially your single vineyard, but even the blends, and be like, no. You can drink these wines. These wines, they will remind you of Burgundy. So before we get anything specific, congratulations. The three different single vineyard Pinots we tried, the best thing I can say, they all tasted different. And yet the grapes, they're not that far apart from one another, are they?
No. In fact, in 2018, we released four Pinot Noirs that were all within 800 yards of the winery and each other. Yet these vineyards are all distinct. And, you know, in much like in Burgundy, as you mentioned, there are each vineyard has its own expression, and the French came up with the word called terroir to describe just that. The combination of exposure, soil, microclimate, all of these things come together to make each wine or each vineyard rather has a different story to tell. And the cool thing is Chardonnay and Pinot Noir are two of the grape varietals that best transfer terroir. They're the best vehicles for sort of understanding a vineyard. And in this area, you can move a few yards and get a vineyard with a different character, and that's precisely what we've done. And so we don't have a reserve line. Our upper tier are the single vineyard wines, because that notion of place has always been more important to me than varietal itself. When you're drinking a glass of wine, you're drinking a snapshot of a place and a time.
What does, and we're going to bounce around just to add them to your autobiographical, but I'm going to warn the audience, we are going to do some nerdy stuff. There's going to be soil. There's going to be some hot Cooper talk on this as we talk some oak, but it's always controversial, the idea of terroir, and everyone has their own definition of it. What does limestone mean to you, and what does it mean to Ontario Chardonnay and Pinot Noir?
Well, you know, it's hard to isolate one particular factor when you're talking about a region's wine. But what I notice is that the wines, the Chardonnay and Pinot Noir that I've liked the most in my life, come from places with limestone-based soils. And there are a lot of different kinds of soil in different wine regions, and that's what makes those. So the wines, you know, the wines from Bordeaux are the wines from Bordeaux because of the soil there. Likewise, you know, the volcanic wines from southern Italy or all of these places have their own thing. But for me, Chardonnay and Pinot Noir in limestone, particularly in a cool climate as we have here, you know, have you get this beautiful combination of cooler fruits with and you know, it's a cool expression of those varietals, but with a sense of minerality that tends to come from these limestone based soils. And I'm not gonna, you know, you did warn them. I am prone to get geeky, but with you know, this notion of minerality is something that the scientists will say, well, there's no trace minerals in the wine, and they're absolutely right. That's why I say a sense of minerality rather than minerality itself. And really, what it means to me is it's a good descriptor, because when you taste the Chardonnay and you get that, you know, that nice powerful Chardonnay fruit, but then it yields in the mid palate to that stoniness. And that, you know, that sort of it's a flavor as much as it is a sensation that you have of a wine that's come from a place where the soils have something to say.
Mm-hmm. It is. It's always hard to define. It's one of the things. It's hard to define, but you always know it when you're tasting it.
That's absolutely right. And I think, you know, we've all had those, you know, those wines, whether it's from Chablis or, you know, I can give you lots of other examples too, where it's like, that's what the best descriptor is. It's like, it's not a fruit flavor. It's not an earthiness so much. It's almost something that's more akin to stone, even though we don't go around licking rocks.
How hard is it to live up to your mission statement on the website? And again, Cloudsley Cellars, we are here in Vineland, in just outside of St. Catharines, in the Bench, right near the escarpment. And it's only Cloudsley Cellars. It's Chardonnay. It's Pinot. It's a classic Burgundian house. Your mission statement, unmotivated by consumer trends. How difficult is it to always live up to that mission statement? Because you've got taxes, bills, mortgage. You got all those things that every other human being has to deal with.
I don't pretend that we're not trying to make wines that people are going to like. Of course, that's what we're doing. But we're a very small winery. And it was apparent to me from the beginning that I wanted this project to be small, because I could only do it the way I wanted to if we were small, right? You can't get great vineyards. There are, you know, these vineyards aren't big, and there aren't a lot of great Chardonnay and Pinot vineyards around. And so, you know, Niagara is not a massive region. And so these and the best sites are the best sites, and they're not, you know, there aren't too many. And so I wanted it to be small. So with that said, I don't need to appeal to everyone. I need to make wines that I like, and then find that there are, you know, and I find that there are people who have similar taste to me. And we've been overwhelmed by the response. You know, people really love our wines, and that's great. But what I don't want is to, you know, say, oh, this year, you know, Pet Nat is popular, and which is great, but, you know, that's not what I want to do, or I don't want to make Gewurztraminer just because I can. I wanted to really focus on Chardonnay and Pinot. I want to make it in a certain style that I think elevates those, you know, gets the best out of those vineyards, and I don't want to compromise. Fortunately, thus far, we've been able to do it.
Yeah, and I mean this fortunately and unfortunately. At the same time, yeah, like a lot of your single vineyard, your wines are selling out, and that's great for you. It's horrible for me, because there's things again I'm going to buy at the end of all this. How did the world of Burgundy? How did it first come into your life? Because you were selling wines, you were working for ages one of the largest wine consignment companies, Lifford Wine and Spirits.
Yeah, so I started working with Lifford in 1997 and was there for 17 years. And for the first 15 of those years, I sold Burgundy. You know, we represented Maison Louis Jadot, which is one of the great historic négociants in Burgundy and based in Beaune. And it was through learning, you know, you want to sell a producer like that has the breadth of Burgundy from top to bottom. And you know, you have to learn about Burgundy. So I studied it and I tasted, and I was, look, I'm in this business because I'm passionate about it. So on parallel to, you know, to selling wine, I was learning about wine, reading something every day. I had a very avid tasting group, like, you know, people who were just super keen to taste the best wines in the world. And more, I just fell in love with Burgundy. And if you want to understand it, you got to go deep, because it's a lot of geography, and you know, you got to sift through the, you know, some producers are better than others, and you want to figure it out. You got to know the vintages and all this sort of stuff. And so through that process, more and more the wines that I was willing to spend irresponsibly on and you know, break the bank were those great wines of Burgundy. And through that process, I learned what I liked about in Pinot Noir and Chardonnay.
Yeah, and if it's when it comes to good Burgundy, you are going to have to spend irresponsibly and you're going to have to break the bank.
And in some cases, you're going to have to get lucky because these wines are hard to find. Not only in this market, but all over because, the demand has gone up and they're not making these vineyards bigger. It's not like, if you have a brewery that's doing well and you've got a recipe, you can scale that up as far as you want to go. That's not the case with wine. Romani Conti's not getting any bigger.
No, you're right. And in New World, if you find an area in the New World where you're making great wine, there's a chance for you to expand. And okay, we make 1,000 cases. Now we can make 1,800 cases. And maybe you can still do it where the quality level is only going down a little bit. But you're right. In Burgundy, that's it. Here's the land.
Well, it depends. I mean, to your example, absolutely. If you were making sort of a mid-level Napa cab, you could put together something that was, but if you start doing single vineyard wines and terroir focused, winemaking, you really are restricted. Mm-hmm. And obviously Pinot and Niagara, cause there's not that much of it, particularly, that's got some vine age, which is, we like to work with vineyards that have been around for a while, because that's when you really start to see the quality.
Love to talk about your relationship with the grape growers. You don't yourself personally own the land, but you have relationships with some of the best, if not the best vineyards in Niagara, where it's like Wismer and Foxcroft and Parkey and Glen Elgin. I was wondering if you could talk about what is your relationship with the Niagara grape growers?
Well, it's the most important relationship I have in the business because, you can't make great wine without great grapes. And when I came into this, when I started the project, I had a couple options. I was looking at possibly buying a vineyard. I didn't want to buy land and plant because I wanted to get going on it. And I'm not, super young anymore. And so I didn't want to wait, and I realized you don't know a vineyard's good until you've tasted wine from it, from those grapes. But also it just takes a while for the vines to mature. And so I was never uncomfortable with the idea of not having solely estate fruit because I've sold some of the best wines in the world that aren't estate. I sold Heights Cellars out of Napa Valley for 17 years. Their most famous wine going back to the 60s is Martha's Vineyard. The Heights family never owned Martha's Vineyard. They made it every year. They had a long-term relationship, a friendship with the people who owned the vineyard. And that's sort of the model that I'm going on. The Wismer family in particular are good friends, and we get the same rows every year. They're custom farmed for us to our specifications. And I couldn't be happier working with the people who do their job well. Because I'm not a grower, and it's a very different thing. They happen to own, and others that I work with own what I think are the best bench vineyards here. And I'm not shy about wanting to only work with the best vineyards.
I started to learn this more a year or so ago when I was starting to do the podcast and talking to more winemakers. And the obvious one is Thomas Batchelder, but even my good friend Andre Prue, who's been able to source from some of these vineyards as well for his Chardonnay and his Rosé. And it's true. Like when I see Wismer or Foxcroft or Wingfield or Parkey, I get a sense of, oh, okay. At the very least, I understand this is probably going to be a good wine and it's justified if the price is 30, 35, 40, 50, whatever it is. How much give and take is there? You said you have your rows with these Wismer vineyards and they're custom grown. How much or custom cultivated farm, yeah, whatever term you want to use. What's the give and take with you and the wine growers in terms of making sure you guys are both on the same page?
Well, it's a funny system because in Ontario we have, and this is sort of in the weeds a bit, but there's a grape growing board here. All the grapes have to be sold through them. And they fix the prices, and it's a per ton price, and it's really set up for quantity, not quality. Mm. And so what we do is we make an arrangement with the grower that we will pay them a premium on top of that in order for them to take the extra time and care, and more importantly, reduce the yield so that we get the quality. If you're trying to make great wine, you can't let the vine produce as much grapes as it wants. And so I would rather pay twice as much and have them produce half as much.
Right. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
In order to get the quality. And because in the end, we're not, if we were fighting to compete at $15 a bottle with people, we wouldn't be able to do that. But we price the wines in such a way that we can use the growers can grow them properly, and we can use all the techniques we need to use to make the best possible wine. And that's all it is.
There's no way any of these wines I've tried could be $15. These are definitely hand harvested, low yield. That's all you need to say. Hand hard, yeah. Low yield. Also French oak, 15%, around 15%, or whatever
more,
it is.
Yeah.
Or a new French oak.
Yeah.
You couldn't do that for $15.
No, you can't. I mean, an oak, by the time you get a French oak, like a Burgundian barrel here landed from a top producer, and we pay extra for an extra year of air drying and all this stuff, you know, specific forests. By the time it gets here, it's like $1,300-$1,400 a barrel,
right?
And so it's you know, there are certain things like that. And also, you know, our fruit comes in, it's handpicked in small baskets. It's brought here, it's hand sorted. Every bunch is looked at to make sure it's okay. We pull out a lot. We end up not using a lot of, all these things are, these are all things that are, that you can only do when you're doing high quality small batch winemaking.
Declassifying. You have four different single vineyard Pinots, but you don't always release four different single vineyard Pinots. I was wondering about the decision behind that. And so if one specific vineyard site, if the weather isn't great, if it's not living up to your expectations, you won't sell it. And so then that wine will go more to your $35 level, your more regional, you know, Village.
Yeah, exactly. And so what it is, you know, we're currently working with six or seven different vineyards in Pinot, and depending on the vintage, and it's all the wine start is made in the same way. And then at the end, we taste each vineyard and we try and make an assessment. We taste all the barrels, classify them, you know, with a rating system, and then we start blending, and we see if we can come up with a blend that A is of a very high quality, because it's, you know, all of our single vineyards are $50 a bottle, and that's a lot of money to ask someone to pay.
Yep.
And I want to make sure that we're offering value even at that price point. And then if it meets that, if it meets a quality level, and very importantly, if it's distinct and it tells a story, you know, a different story than the other single vineyards, then we'll release it. That's almost easier. The harder one is to make our 20-mile bench blend, because the quality there is has to be fantastic, and you're mixing together different vineyards, and you're trying to come up with a slightly larger blend. I mean, or maybe 350 cases rather than 100, like with a single vineyard, or in some of them as low as 30 cases with the single vineyards. But that's really the biggest job that we have after the winemaking itself is blending. It's not, if we had one wine, it would be simple. Oh, just dump everything together. But we don't do that, and we don't do anything by recipe. And, you know, people are always amazed when I tell them that when we're tasting and we're doing our blending, we will tweak the new oak levels by as much as 1 or 2% and try every different combination. And 1 or 2% can make a very, very big difference if you're adding, you know, few liters from one barrel into a blend can really, really change things. And people do have a hard time but believing that. But when you're really dialed in tasting, and we do it, as a team here, with our winemaking team here and our consultant, it's amazing how much you can pick out of that tiny little difference. And so we're taking the time to do that, because in the end, I want to like the wines too. So,
of course. What is the specific, if you take me through just a couple of those specific steps that leads you to deciding, nope, we're not releasing any single vineyard wine for this vintage from this specific vineyard.
Yeah, it's really, I don't want to sound like, you know, the all important decider, but in the end, it's
someone has to be.
It's a gut thing for me, and you know, in the case of the Chardonnays, in 18, we didn't release single vineyard Chardonnays. They were very good wines. Stylistically, the vintage produced wine that wasn't exactly my ideal, and I knew how good our 17s were. I knew what we had in barrel already for 19, and I didn't feel like there was any, you know, I didn't need to compromise. And even though the others in the room said, look, they're just different expressions, and to that, and they may have been right that they were very good expressions of that vintage. And that's important too. But I didn't feel good about charging $50 for them. So instead, we made a seriously awesome 20-mile bench blend, because all those best barrels went into that instead.
Right.
And so in some ways, and every time I try that wine, I kind of wonder whether I made the right decision. But that's life.
Yeah, the what ifs. Yeah. Oh, my God, the what ifs. How much of an, you don't have to go specific numbers, but how much of an economic impact is it on you when you go, nope, shut her down. We can't turn this into a 50 into our single vineyard. We're going to use all the juice and make, as you said, a kick-ass regional $35 bottle.
When we're making wine, when we're blending wine, I try my hardest to turn off that side of my brain that has to pay the bills and look after the, and then what I do is after I come up with what I would like to do, then I step back and I say, okay, how does this work from a business standpoint? And in the end, as long as the lights are kept on and as long as it's on balance, everything together produces a tenable business situation, I don't mind if one specific SKU loses me money,
right,
or if in one vintage even, if the margin's a little bit less because of that overall, because I'm trying to do something here for the long haul and I'm trying to not compromise at all. And I think in the long run, that'll pay off, because the wineries that I most respect in the world are the ones that take that approach.
So. Right. Was there a moment that turned you where you're like, okay, like you're selling for Lifford, you're trying all these great wines. I mean, Jadot on its own is going to give you everything from fantastic Village to Grand Cru crazy stuff and everything in between.
There wasn't one bottle that turned me and said, look, I'm hanging up my skates here and going and getting into the production side of things. But there certainly were wines that were epiphany moments as far as tasting Burgundy over the years. I remember tasting with the, you know, at a dinner, this is going back 20 years, at North 44, and tasting a, you know, 1985 Jadot Clos Saint-Jacques, and I think it was an 82 Corton Charlemagne from Jadot as well with the export director there. And realizing that, like, you know, I could barely concentrate on the conversation because it was, the wines were so good. And you know, there have been many others as well. But those kind of moments where you see great wines that, and particularly, you know, excellent bottles of those great wines at perfect age with the right food and great company. And I was, those were moments that made me think, okay, there's a whole other level to this.
I found like my moments, like the first moment, I've said this so many times on the pod, so I won't go into much detail. Just, it was a super old brick orange Barolo. And I just, like on those moments where something's great, I get the hair stands on my forearm and I just start laughing. Like I start laughing a bit because I'm like, this is ridiculous. What the hell is going on? Like that's how it always expresses it with me.
I agree with you. And the amazing thing to me is that after 25 years or almost 25 years in the business, and sort of, you know, you can easily get caught up in the, you know, in any business, it can seem like it doesn't matter what you're selling in the end. And, you know, in those days where you're working and there's, you know, when you're dealing with the drudgery of any job, but through all of that, I never lost my passion for wine, and I still get giddy when I have, like, when I crack open a great bottle from my cellar, and I did it last week with some friends, and we opened up some really a great Barolo, for example. And you know, that to me is like, you know, that shows me I'm still doing what I should be doing when I get as excited as I did when I was trying those wines for the first time.
I think it's so important because the job is a leap of faith. You don't have control. Everything is going great, and then suddenly hail comes, or it's the middle of May and there's a frost, and then suddenly all that work goes down the drain. If you don't have that giddiness, then it just becomes a real, just every day is a slog.
Well, there's no question there are easier pursuits in the world.
Yes, there is. Absolutely. what was your first vintage like? Because I know 2017, I think it was 2017 is when you made it here on this site where we're doing this podcast.
Yeah, so 2017 was the first year for Chardonnay, and although it was the third year for Pinot, it was the first year that we did it on site. First couple of vintages I made at another winery, and you know, it was very much like with the same process. But just done on someone else's property,
right?
Someone else's facility. But certainly, you know, so 2015 was wonderful because it was a great year. We're really blessed to have a first year of making a vinifying Pinot in a year that was my kind of vintage. You know, it was not too hot. It was we had a really nice harvest period. Great, you know, not too much rain. It was just a really and produced beautiful wines. 16 was a really hot year. Which we had to be very careful not to get, you know, jammy wines, and we were successful in that, and they drank really well. And then 17, our first vintage here, again, we got really lucky. We had like the ideal Chardonnay vintage, which was just a real joy.
How different would you say you are now? And I ask this of like everyone. So for the listeners, they're probably expecting this question. How different are you now as a winemaker than 2015?
I continue every day at this to learn. And you know, there's no... As a wine drinker, you can't learn everything about wine. And you certainly can't as on the winemaking side. I learn a tremendous amount. As I mentioned, my background was in the sales and importation side. You know, I did not go to wine school, so I'm really learning all the time, all the science. But what I have, I certainly since 15, I've gotten to know the vineyards better, because you can't know a vineyard in one vintage. It takes time.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know, you know, getting back to Jadot, Jacques Lardier, who was there for 40 years, you know, he saw those same vineyards 40 years. And that is, you know, the knowledge you build up in that time is, you know, you can't teach that quickly. You've got to, you got to live it. And so I've certainly been learning a ton, and but I feel, to be honest, like we're still, like I'm still just scratching the surface.
What's the community like here? You know, in certain parts of the world, in parts of France, everything's much more secretive and combative. Other parts, it's, you know, more a community spirit. What's Niagara like here for you?
You know, that's one thing that was a really nice surprise when I got down here. You know, I knew a lot of people in the business here before, and I knew that, you know, there were people who were friends with each other. But there really is a tremendous sense of community amongst the winemakers. Certainly here on the bench, but throughout Niagara, I you know, consider friends, you know, like many, many winemakers and people in the wine business here, winery owners. And generally speaking, people are really, really keen to help out and you know, to offer advice. There's not a lot of protecting, you know, not a lot of secrets. People, because I think that the wisest in the industry realize that if everyone is making better wine, it's going to raise the profile of the region, and that's going to be good for everyone. And so we're you know, you mentioned Thomas Batchelder before. Well, Thomas has you know, he will taste our wines, we'll taste his, we'll call each other to discuss you know, the vintage or particular issues we might be having with fermentations or whatever, and we're very eager to share with each other, because I want nothing more than for him and all the other producers to make great wine, because that'll brighten the spotlight on our region.
Right. Yeah. You know, like floats, what's the expression?
A rising tide floats all boats.
Thank you. I'm glad you said that, Adam, because I would have spent the next 45 seconds just bungling that term. And you're right, because people now are going to hear about Cloudsley. You came on the radar for me about a year ago. And people are like, oh, you got to try them. And, you know, there was... You know, 13th Street, oh, the June's Vineyard, this, and Henry of Pelham, the Cuvée Catherine. And there's always these wines out there throughout Niagara. And the more they become respected and sought after, then you're right. Then it just helps everyone else around.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, you mentioned earlier that person who may have a misconception about the quality in Niagara. We're a young region. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to say they've always made the best wines here, and I'm not going to say that every producer's making the best wine. But that's not true in any region. And every region in the world has made improvements over the years. We had some catching up to do because we've only really been at it with these, you know, European varietals for a small number of decades here. And so, you know, the viticulture has really improved in the last 20 years, and the winemaking's really improved in the area in general. If you go out and seek the best producers of any given varietal here, you will find some surprisingly exceptional wines. Mm-hmm. And I say surprising because I was one of these people, you know, who always found, you know, that it was always maybe a surprise 25 years ago to have a great Ontario wine, because there were there, but you'd have a lot that were maybe a little more ordinary. That's not the case anymore. Even the bigger producers making larger quantities are doing a much better job than they were, because we've all learned, and the vines have gotten older, and we've figured out how to farm in this area properly, all these things.
Yeah, it's the same thing, you know, in sports. How does a team get better? Sometimes it's as boring an answer as, you see your young players that are talented, well, they need to grow and they got to learn. I'm not going to use the Leafs as an example because that's a bad one, because bleep them and I'm going to get angry.
I'm not ready to talk about
that.
No,
I don't want to talk about it as well. I got to talk about every goddamn day. But how do you get better? Sometimes just time. And it's such a boring answer, but time. Time means people get better at viticulture. They recognize, oh, this vineyard site should be this grape and not this grape. And also, the vines get older. And as they get older, it can add more quality and depth and complexity. And sometimes you just got to wait.
That's true. And we really, you know, I'm very proud to be part of this, the Niagara winemaking community here, because there are so many great people making so many great wines. And I encourage anyone who's skeptical to come on down here, talk to people who know the area, figure out where to go, and I can guarantee you're going to find wines you love.
And try to come on a weekday, because there's nothing worse. If you go to a vineyard on a Saturday and you see the bus, not here because you guys are smaller, yeah, you see the bus pulling up with the Stagette or the group of eight guys, just move on to the next vineyard. Move on to the next vineyard.
Well, we're kind of set up. We're not set up for buses, and I don't want to be. We do a very small number of people through here. We try and take the time. When you come here, you know, I can't say this will always be the case, but you're either talking to me, assistant winemaker, Eden, or Matt Smith, our winemaker, Eden Gary, our assistant winemaker. You know, you're talking to one of the three of us, so someone who's involved in the winemaking process. And that's very important to me, that we're able to relay not only our passion for what we do, but, you know, to be able to answer the specifics about what makes our wines different and what, you know, and when someone has a question, that we can answer them. And quite frankly, all three of us really enjoy that interaction.
Of course.
I you know, talking to people who are enjoying your wine is one of the most validating parts of the job. In fact, I'd say it probably is the most.
Of course, it's your blood, sweat, and tears, and you're seeing, you know, it's like doing stand-up comedy. You're going to get immediate reaction. And your first joke, if everyone's laughing, you're going to feel good about it. It's the same thing. You poured, you poured your regional Chardonnay, and immediately, just big smile on my face, because the aromatics, everything that I love about like high-end Niagara Chard was there. And yeah, you get that reaction. Again, though, for the listeners, if there is someone standing behind you, don't ask the winemaker about the oak treatment, because the person behind you also wants to get wine. When there's no one around, then ask. In fact, I'll save you the time. Adam, I just, you know, I've read a bunch in interviews with you. What does oak mean to you and the importance of it? And of course, I'll do the proviso. As you already said, you only use so much oak, maybe 15%, maybe 16%, but if you get to 19%, it's ruined. Well, but what does oak mean to you?
Well, those numbers aren't exact. I know you're just using it as an example. But I'll tell you, the style of Chardonnay that we want to make here in Niagara, I think requires oak aging. And we use only French oak. We use Burgundian Coopers, and likewise for the Pinot, although, you know, you don't see stainless steel aged Pinot at a serious level anywhere. So that's why I was talking about Chardonnay, because there is a lot of great Chardonnay in the world that's made with steel. For some reason, which I don't know why, My favorite wines from Niagara have always been barrel fermented and barrel aged. With that said, we're really, really careful about the barrels we use. So we get specific forests that have very specific toast levels from particular coopers that we trust, and we don't stray too far from that. And if we try a cooper out, we'll get one barrel or two and try it out for a year or two. And you know, so really, and I did a lot of extensive tasting in other cellars to try and figure out which direction I wanted to go, because that is a really, really big decision. And it's one you can control, whereas you can't control the weather and you know, what the vintage is going to bring you, but you can sure control the oak. So it's a place where we never skimp financially. The amount of new oak we use is not a recipe. I started off with about 25% in the cellar total. We've dialed that back to about 20, because we do all of our blending. It's not a recipe. It's just done by taste. What we found is, for a couple of years, we had one extra new barrel that we had to sort of kick forward a vintage because or put into a wait a year and put it into one of our lower wines because I will not, I don't want to drink wine where oak is the first thing that I taste. And so, depending on we've gone as high on Chardonnay as 50%, which on a single vineyard, which is, I never thought we would do.
Really?
But you know what? The blend, that's what was, there were particularly elegant barrels, very subtle oak flavor, and the fruit was powerful enough that it could handle it. So I had to sort of break with my preconceived notion and go with my palate, and that wine was fantastic. We've gone as low on single vineyard Pinot as 16%, and as high as 33. So it really did, everything is done by with tasting, not with, I try and, you got to think about it. You got to have theories and all this stuff, but in the end, you got to trust your palate and go with it.
That's gutsy on two levels. It's gutsy on one level because you're the one making the decision, and then it's then going to go in the bottle and it's going to sit and you're like, oh boy, I hope I made the right decision. But also what I appreciate, and it's one thing I love about good Burgundy houses, is every vintage tastes different. And the gutsy part about that is, you could, more mass produce wine. And if people like the 1 year, it's like, okay, that's our recipe, folks. And we're going to try to replicate it each and every year, which may be able to guarantee you, okay, maybe we're going to be able to sell more because everyone is going to, they have the same expectations versus, all right, you might have loved 17, 18 is going to be different.
Well, everywhere in the world, vintages are different, but there's certainly more consistency in some regions than there is in a place like Niagara. If you wanted to make a wine that tasted the same every year here, you would have to do a tremendous degree of manipulation, and you would never make a great wine that way, in my estimation. Others may argue that, but we have to embrace vintage variation here. And you know what? Sometimes those hot years are great. The wines are great, and sometimes the cooler years are great. The impressive thing, and you'll see this, you don't have to only look in Niagara for this. Look in Burgundy. If you go back to the 70s, there were a lot of crappy vintages. Well, the off vintages now, you can find from the better producers, you find great wines because they've figured out how to do it in those years, and sometimes they have to make a lot less. But they have, partly because they're well-financed now, their wines sell for so much money.
A lot of insurance companies, a lot of giant corporations now own these.
Or just over these families have seen the prices go up over years. So they can afford to maybe not produce all the, not use every bunch, even though, throw stuff away if need be, because it's rot, it has a little rot or whatever. Whatever the reason, there are a lot of technical advances that have been made. But the main thing is that, the vintage is part of the story. So you have your vineyard, you have your varietal, and you have the vintage. And those things together make the wine in front of you. And I don't want to drink the same thing all the time. I don't want to drink my wine all the time, let alone the same vintage of my wine all the time, because that's the beauty of wine. That's why it's not Coca-Cola where it's the same every time. That would be so incredibly uninteresting.
Speaking of vintages, August in Southern Ontario has been hot as hell. And it's funny, you had like crazy rain in July, but now you got like hot as hell August. What What does that mean for you? What does that mean for Niagara? What does a super hot August mean for the winemaker in this region?
Well, I touched on the vintage variability before, and I'll say like an anecdote. When I came down here, naively years ago, I asked a vineyard owner what's it like in an average year. He said, "There's no average years here. Right. Nothing. There's not. Every year is so different." And this year is really weird, like all of them. You know, you get this year, it has felt, living down here, like it was a much wetter summer than it's been, because we had rain periodically, but it never rained a ton, and so the ground's been really dry, but the air's been really wet. Like it's been super humid here, right? So the grapes don't feel that. They don't know that you know, they think it's 30 degrees, even though it feels like 40 to us,
right?
And it feels unbearable. So it's actually not as extreme for the grapes as it feels. I, you know, just the other day talking to a vineyard manager, and the feeling is that, yeah, with this heat lately, and particularly the fact that the nights have been warmer, we are accelerating. We're going to be coming to an earlier harvest than maybe we thought a few weeks ago, but it's not going to be crazy, and who knows? I mean, you know, a lot of this stuff is speculation, and I've talked to people with a whole lot of more experience than me and a lot of years under their belt, and they won't say definitively what kind of vintage it's going to be, because there's still time. But I will say that here we're sitting at the end of August, here we are probably going to be seeing sparkling wine grapes picked in Niagara starting next week or the week after, and I'd say still wines probably a week or two earlier than they would normally be, so maybe mid-September,
right?
Mid to late September, as opposed to the end of September, early October.
How much variation do you have in terms of picking for your different single vineyard Pinots?
Well, the Pinots generally are within a couple weeks of each other, mm-hmm. And sometimes even all of it within about a week to 10 days. Chardonnay's a little bit more, because we've got one vineyard we deal with, Wismer Wingfield, which is always the last thing we pick. It's only about 800 yards away from the Foxcroft Vineyard and the Cuesta Vineyard, but we pick it, 2 to 4 weeks later, and it just...
What is it about Chardonnay Drab? What is it geographically? Does it get more or less wind? Is there something different with shade, or what happens?
So it's higher on the hill, which you might think is actually going to be warmer, but it's tucked in the trees a bit, and it's sheltered from some of the sunshine because of that. Also in the slope there is a factor that I think is significant is there's less clay in the vineyard, and so clay retains heat a lot more than other soil elements, and so I think it's just it loses its heat quicker. They're old vines by Niagara standards. They're planted in 1993. And for whatever reason, they take their time, mm-hmm. and they never get, super ultra ripe, but they get just ripe enough. And we get, those really true cool climate Chardonnay flavors out of that vineyard that I love so much.
So Adam, help out the listeners here. They're not going to do Burgundy because their kid's in school and they're sending them to private school. They've already got a bunch of Ontario wine, not because they're good Canadians, but because they like good wine. So they're not going to go Burgundy. They're not going to go Ontario. And again, shout out Prince Edward County. A lot of good stuff there as well. What other country do you love? Like, if you're going to be drinking a Pinot that's not Canadian and it's not French, or Chardonnay as well, where do you go?
Well, in Pinot, there are some very good areas in California. It's not generally my go-to place, even though if I admire that style, and there's some impeccably made wines up in the Russian River and in some of the coastal regions in Northern California, and even in, even south of there in some of these valleys, like in Santa Rita Hills and places mm-hmm. like that. That's not my go-to generally. I like some of the places in Oregon. For sure. I think Oregon's a really interesting style of Pinot. It's kind of that part way. It's not quite as California, if you will, as far as ripeness levels. And then an area that I've always loved, or well, since I was, you know, because I used to sell a lot of it, and I've been down there and gone to the Pinot Noir conference down there a couple times, is New Zealand.
Yeah.
And particularly the South Island, well, Martinborough and the south part of the North Island, and but really central Otago in the southern part of the South Island, there are some tremendous wineries there. And there's something about New Zealand that... There's a quality to the fruit there that's just sort of, everything's sort of amped up. It's punchy. It's got a, you know, in the same way that their Sauvignon Blancs really sort of bursting in your face, the Pinots too have a ripeness, and it's not like they're overripe, stewy. It's just all the flavors are very vibrant, almost like on steroids. You know, it's just really and you know, you go down there and you have the produce is like that too. You have a plum, it's like that too. They're just, the flavors are really, really punchy. Now, at times, it's a little too much fruit mm-hmm. for me. Like I like wine that has, you know, sort of a balance between fruity elements and then other stuff going on too. But I really admire those wines, and I love you know, what a lot of the great, you know, I used to sell Craggy Range and Felton Road and you know, others from New Zealand, and I really love those wines, and there's so many great people down there too.
Agreed. I did a 2-week trip in North Island, Waiheke Island, stunned by how good the Bordeaux blends were. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, tourist area. Oh, there'll be some fun novelty wines. I'm like,
no,
these are serious ones. Gimlet Gravels, obviously the Syrah and the Merlot and things like that. But there's one place, Elephant Hill.
Yeah.
I remember trying their first vintage Chardonnay and just absolutely loving it. Craggy Range, as you mentioned.
Yeah, well, you mentioned that Gimlet Gravels, that Hawke's Bay area.
Woo.
You said Syrah. That's sort of an unknown thing outside of New Zealand to a lot of people. That particular area, for whatever reason, makes just amazing Syrah. Yeah. Really, really interesting. And I don't think there's enough of it to really have gained too much international attention, but man, is it ever good.
You'll find this strange. I went to New Zealand and I drank zero Sauvignon Blanc. It was all Bordeaux blends. It was all Chardonnay, and actually a couple of, like, sneaky, really good Rieslings.
Oh,
as well.
Absolutely! The aromatics there, Pinot Gris as well. There, like, there's a lot of really interesting stuff there that surprised me when I went. Riesling was one of them. In fact, I had afterwards imported just for myself some. You know, we brought in some for ourselves. Some Riesling from some of these producers, because it wouldn't be easy to sell here, but we wanted to drink them. So
as we end this, I was wondering if you could give just a quick review just of your single vineyard Pinots, because the ones we tried first one, and we tried them before the start of this interview. First one, much more perfumed and delicate. The third one, and you know, had the most power. The second one, a little bit more. I hate to use the word blood, this blood metallic cherry thing, iron quality to it. And again, kudos to you, your winemaking team, and the grape growers. Again, it takes a village to make a good wine. All of them, they were very distinct despite geographically being so close to one another.
Yeah, and so the four single vineyard Pinots in 18, we have Glen Elgin Vineyard, which is a site just a little bit southeast. East of the and up the slope a bit from the winery. That is a vineyard that has very thin soils, not a lot of clay content, tends to produce a lot of like sort of reb fruit with a really nice sense of minerality. In this year, it's a little wilder on the nose than in previous years, which I love. It's just super complex. I can't stop, you know, getting my nose in that glass when I have it in front of me. And then just below that is Cuesta Vineyard, which is, I think, the most beautiful vineyard around. It's not, you know, there's no buildings there. You can't go in there as a tourist, I'm afraid, but it's just stunning when you see it. And that's just below, like down the escarpment, slightly from Glen Elgin. And I agree with you, that sort of iron element. I will tell people there is no blood in the wine at all, but it does taste like that sort of slight iron rustiness that I really like, and that's definitely different from all the other single vineyards. And then we move towards the winery a little bit closer, and just to the north we have Park Vineyard, which is definitely, as you quite rightly said, it is the biggest of the bunch, and really beautiful vineyard, and consistently excellent year in and year out. And I've tried other winemakers' examples of it for years, and really fantastic. And then just to the north of that, just before you get to the bottom of the, or just to the hill that slopes down to King Street, is Hank Vineyard. And even though it's separated literally at you know, by a headland, by like, you know, 30 feet or whatever it is, the vines are different. Like the vineyard's different, and there's a real you know, it's got some of Park's power, but there's an elegance there that's a little bit, there's a silkiness there. And I just can't, you know, it's amazing how such a small difference in slope and distance can yield such a different wine. And it really is, you know, if they weren't different, we wouldn't have bottled them separately.
Of course.
But the fact that we can have four wines from the same varietal, farmed the same way, produced in the same way, all within 800 yards that taste so different from each other, is as much a validation of the notion of terroir as you'll see in Ontario.
Love it. Adam Lowry from Cloudsley Cellars. I think I said Lowry because I got Kyle Lowry on.
That's all right. We're not related. It's Lowy. But,
yes. No. I know. even before, when I was telling people, oh yeah, Adam Lowry, and then I see the name, and my brain, the sports side says Lowry, but the Burgundy side must say Lowy. Congratulations! Really impressive expression of the land. And I love the fact you followed your passion and that it's going well so far. Obviously, I'm sure you have rooms of things you want to do better at, blah, blah, blah. But these are incredible wines, well worth the price. If people want to find you, website, phone number, where do they go?
Yeah, cloudsleycellars.com. You can always call us. During the summer, we're open every day. We're very small here, so as we get into harvest, it'll be by appointment only, and we can't always accommodate people because we got to make wine too.
Yeah.
But if you're ever have a question about it, give us a call. Chances are you'll find me answering the phone, and I'd love to talk to you and introduce you to our wines.
A damn impressive lineup. Congratulations, Adam. And by the way, thank you for taking the time for doing the podcast today.
It's a pleasure, Matt. It's been fun.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Stitcher, Spotify, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.